All right, how's everybody doing? Hotep, hey, this is Michael M. Hotep, founder of the African History Network, host of the African History Network show. We're finally live. It is Sunday, July 21st, 2019, and we're live all the way from Atlanta. So I'm here in Atlanta for the 8th Annual Liberated Minds Black Homeschool and Education Expo. Today was the last day of the expo. It's been a very busy day. I wanted to broadcast the show at my normal time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the African History Network show. So everybody, welcome to the African History Network show, special Sunday night edition from Hotlanta. It is hot here in Atlanta. So I have the air conditioning on here in the hotel room. And normally I'm on 9:10 a.m. the Superstation WFDF Sunday nights, but I'm here for the conference, and I'm here each year for the Liberated Minds Black Homeschool and Education Expo, and I'm a presenter and one of the vendors. So I was doing my presentation this morning, okay, and I dealt with six principles of political self-defense, six principles of political self-defense, understanding how public policies and laws affect the black economic condition. All right, so I'm going to give you a synopsis of what my presentation was on, and I recorded it, so we'll have it available on DVD later this week at AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. So how's everybody doing tonight? I wanted to broadcast at 9 p.m. I was tired. I've been up since about 6 a.m. this morning, because I was at the conference at the Georgia Piedmont Technical Center. I think I got there about 9 a.m., and I was the first presenter. So I got there early to test out the equipment and get everything together, and had to, I was at my vendor table also, okay? So everybody share this broadcast on your Facebook page, and invite your friends to tune in also. African American business owners, post the name of your business here on the thread of the broadcast. We'll let you know how you can advertise with the African History Network. To promote your business, email us at customerservice@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Customerservice@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Okay? And check out some of the sponsors of the African History Network show, like theprofitroom.com, theprofitroom.com. And they have classes to help you learn about investing, learn about the foreign exchange markets, etc. Theprofitroom.com, P-R-O-F-I-T. All right, so let's jump into this, and let me share this broadcast on my personal page also, Michael M. Hotep. So give me a minute here. The setup is a little differently here because I'm not in the office. Okay, so it's been a crazy weekend. It's been a crazy week because of Donald Trump attacking four congresswomen of color because he's scared. He knows that he knows Mueller is going to testify on Thursday, and it was postponed for a week. And he knows Mueller knows the truth, and Trump knows Mueller would destroy him, okay? So Trump is running scared right now, and he should be scared because he's guilty. He's a fraud. He's an unindicted co-conspirator. He engaged in campaign finance law violations with the payments to one Stormy Daniels, Tiffany Crawford, okay? And as I talked about today, as I talked about in my presentation this morning at the Black Homeschooling Conference, so on Sundays, the focus is on economic empowerment, okay? And one of the things I talked about in my presentation that I hadn't planned to talk about, but it came up, is that when I first heard the story about payments to Stormy Daniels about 2 months before the 2016 campaign, I said, this sounds like a campaign finance law violation of FEC guidelines, Federal Elections Commission. Sure enough, I was correct, because I was the one that broke that story for 9:10 a.m. the Superstation WFDF. I was the first one on air to talk about that story. Okay, so share this broadcast. African American business owners, post the name of your business here on the thread of the broadcast, and also register for our online course, Ancient Kemet, the Moors, and the Ma'afa. Understanding the transatlantic slave trade, what they didn't teach you in school, ancient Kemet, the Moors, and the Ma'afa. Understanding the transatlantic slave trade, what they didn't teach you in school. Class number 5 is going to be this Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As soon as you register, you can go back and watch the previous courses. This is an 8-week, 16-hour online course that I teach. This Wednesday, we'll get into how the Moors lost control in Europe, especially in Moor Spain. Okay, so the course is $80. You can watch it over and over again. We do the classes live on Wednesdays in the archive, and it's about 36 hours of bonus content. So we posted the link here, and also it's at our website, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. All right, so let's look at this here. And also I want to talk about this article from TheNation.com from July 18th, 2019. It talks about Jackie Robinson testifying in front of the Un-American Activities Committee in 1949 and how he was pitted against Paul Robeson. Okay, I posted an article about this a couple of days ago, and it got a huge response. All right, so what I did was I laid out 6 principles of what I call political self-defense. With the 2020 campaign coming up, we have to understand the need for an African-American agenda. We have to understand how to play this game of politics and win. All right. Now, politics is the legal distribution of scarce wealth, power, and resources, and the writing of laws, statutes, ordinances, amendments, and treaties, their adoption, interpretation, and enforcement. This is an easy way to understand what politics is. The writing of laws, statutes, ordinances, amendments, and treaties, their adoption, interpretation, and enforcement, and the legal distribution of scarce wealth, power, and resources. So this deals with laws, this deals with policies, all of this, okay? We look at the $1.4 trillion tax cut that Trump did, which benefited the top 10%, the top 1%, benefited corporate America at the expense of the other 90% or so of Americans, and added close to $1 trillion to the national debt as well, okay, that our children and our children's children will pay for. Okay, so this is an example of understanding public policy, understanding politics and how this impacts us, okay? So politics impacts every aspect of our lives, from the water we drink to the food we eat to the air we breathe. We look at Flint, Michigan. Flint, Michigan, the disaster in Flint, Michigan. And I live in Detroit, so we knew about it before the rest of the country did. The disaster that happened in Flint, Michigan with the lead-tainted water, that was totally avoidable. Okay? That happened under a Republican governor, Governor Snyder. And this is why Donald Trump didn't talk too much about it, because I guarantee you, if that had been a Democratic governor, Trump would still be talking about it today. All right? So when we look at that, that was an example of how profits were put above people. Profits were put above people. So the city of Flint was taken over by an emergency manager. Okay, that was put in place by Governor Snyder. Because in Michigan, what happened was all of the majority, basically all of the majority African-American cities were taken over by emergency managers so they could gain control of the contracts, push the cities into bankruptcy, take over the cities. This is coming from Lansing. Okay, same thing happened to Detroit. This bankruptcy that came over to Detroit that helped usher in this gentrification, took control over Detroit assets, took control over the water system, took control over Belle Isle, all this stuff. All this stuff was totally engineered, totally manufactured, totally engineered. Detroit did not have to go into bankruptcy, all right? But when we look at Flint, what happened was they were switching getting their water from the Flint water source, from the Detroit water source to their own water system. In the meantime, they decided, through the emergency manager, they decided to get water from the Flint River. Well, many people there in Flint knew the Flint River was toxic. However, All they had to do was use a special, like, anti-corrosive agent or something like that, that would purify the water, okay? That would make the water more drinkable. But they didn't want to do that. It would have cost somewhere between $100 to $150 a day to properly treat the water from the Flint River source, okay, to make it drinkable. They didn't want to do this. They didn't want to spend the money. The water in the Flint River source was 19 times more corrosive than the water coming from the Detroit River source. So what happened was, when this water went through these pipes, went through these lead pipes, and it's 19 times more corrosive, it stripped the lining inside of the lead pipes. There was a protective lining inside of the lead pipes that kept the lead from leaching into the water. Okay? When this water comes through, that's 19 times more corrosive than the water from the Detroit River source, it stripped away that protective lining, which allowed the lead to leach into the water. This could have been avoided by spending between $100 to $150 a day to properly treat the water. But they didn't want to do this. See, this is under Governor Snyder, Republican control. They didn't want to do this. Flint, Michigan, predominantly African American. You got poor whites that live in Flint, Michigan also. Okay? This is an example of putting profit over people. Because Snyder was a Republican governor, you heard Donald Trump say very little about Flint, Michigan. All right. So, let's look at this. Let's look at these six principles quickly here, and I'm going to get to these other topics and get out of here. All right. I was watching MSNBC dealing with the Mueller report. Everybody should go watch that tonight. The 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, it came on, the one-hour special hosted by Ari Melber. Read the Mueller report. Go to NBCNews.com. Search for Read Mueller Report. We'll post a link here also. And watch Mueller testify on Thursday as well. It's going to be explosive. All right, so when we look at six principles of political self-defense, I lay it out as stop, match, create, push, leverage, protect. Stop, match, create, push, leverage, protect. Okay? So we know that politics is the legal distribution of scarce wealth, power, and resources. And two things that we must understand and must master. We must master history and understand history, and we must understand law. Unfortunately, African Americans, we don't understand either one of them. Okay? We were the first people in history. We created history. We were the first people to have laws, and we don't understand either one of them. And this is why it's kicking our behinds. Okay? So, let me give you an example of what I mean. So, laws create conditions. Conditions create movements in response to conditions. Laws are written to address the movements. So, if we look at 246 years of slavery, so June 19th, 2019, we saw the H.R. 40 hearing in the House of Representatives, right, dealing with reparations. And also, I got to tell you, so I talked about reparations today in my presentation. What I said about reparations caused the whole room to go silent. It blew people away because I said something that people hadn't thought about before, okay? Because a lot of the ways that we're going about reparations, a lot of these arguments for reparations are not legal arguments, unfortunately. You've heard me say these before. These are emotional arguments. Many of them are not legal arguments. All right, so 246 years of slavery. We have the abolitionist movement. We have, when we look at the U.S. Constitution, that forms the foundational law of this country, okay? The Constitution sanctioned slavery. Article 4, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution laid the foundation for the Fugitive Slave Laws of 1793 and the Fugitive Slave Laws of 1850, which were even harsher and went beyond the Fugitive Slave Law of 1793, signed into law by President George Washington, who was a slave owner himself, who became a slave owner at the age of 10 when he inherited about 11 slaves from his father, George Washington. Okay, we look at Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. Let me turn the air conditioner on. All right, we look at Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. Oh, I'll turn it down. Hold on. you know, we look at Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. One of the things I talked about today that a lot of people don't understand is that, so when the Constitution is signed September 17, 1787, five states have already outlawed slavery. The first state to outlaw slavery was Vermont, July 2nd, 1777. You're going to have Massachusetts. They outlawed in 1783. And Massachusetts was the first state to have slave laws, going back to 1641. So August 20th, 1619, Jamestown, Virginia, we know this year we're commemorating the year of return and 400 years, 1619 to 2019. One, African people have been in this land going back at least 51,700 years ago. And this is what Dr. David M. Hotep deals with in his book, The First Americans Were Africans, Documented Evidence. Two, when those 29 Africans come into Port Comfort in Jamestown, Virginia, on the White Line slave ship, slave laws don't exist in any of the 13 colonies. The first colony to have slave laws was Massachusetts in 1641. This is something that people don't want to talk about. Those 29 Africans were put into indentured servitude and released after about 3 to 5 years, compensated with land. Read chapter 2 of Before the Mayfly by Lerone Bennett Jr., because he talks about this. People don't want to deal with this. Lerone Bennett Jr. talks about this. And Before the Mayflower, chapter 2, pages about 28 to 40, 6th edition. So the whole way all this evolves, we don't even understand. And this is why a lot of the arguments we're making for reparations are not even legal arguments. They're emotional arguments. This may go outside the circumference of some people's awareness. I'm all for reparations, but we have to make legal arguments, and we have to make it, and one of the reasons why we have to make it a legal argument is because right now, they are challenging the Affordable Health Care Act in the courts, Obamacare in the courts, after the same millions of white people's lives. So if they challenge the Affordable Health Care Act in the courts, you think they're not going to challenge reparations in the courts if we somehow get it? So we're not even, the arguments that we're making, we're not even structuring them in a way that we're making legal arguments so that we can fight it legally when it gets challenged in the courts. And Trump has nominated about 23% of the federal judges. I talked about that today. About almost 1 out of 5 federal judges Trump has nominated. He's nominated 143 federal judges, which is a lifetime appointment. Got 123 of them confirmed. See, people don't want to talk about this. I don't know why. People don't want to talk about this. All right, so laws create conditions. Conditions create movements in response to conditions. Laws are written to address the movements. So we go from the Constitution being signed 1787, being ratified about 1788. We have the Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution laid the foundation for the international transatlantic slave trade to be abolished January 1st, 1808. Most of the people, when I did my presentation today, most people didn't know this. This is law. This is U.S. Constitution. Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. Now, a lot of people know about Article 1, Section 9 because it deals with the Emolument Clause. But the first paragraph deals with the transatlantic slave trade, and it states that the importation, I'm paraphrasing, because nowhere in the Constitution does it use the word slave or slavery, things like this. But what it's saying is that the importation of Africans as slaves, the earliest that can be abolished is 1808. That's in Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution. Go to loc.gov and read the U.S. Constitution. Okay? loc.gov, Library of Congress website. And these are some of the things that we deal with in the online course that I teach also, Ancient Kemet, the Moors, and the Ma'afa, Understanding the Transatlantic Slave Trade, what they didn't teach you in school. Okay, so we're going to post a link here. You can register for the online course. As soon as you register, you can start watching. We meet this Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We deal with thousands of years of history. We deal with these laws, these policies, all this stuff. Okay, this Wednesday we're going to get into how the Moors lost control of Europe, how the Moors lost power in Europe, especially in Spain. Okay, and one of the problems was Moorish men kept intermixing with white women. And not a lot of people want to talk about this. Moorish men. This is what happened. And what's going to happen is that the complexion of Europe starts to change as these Moors intermix with the population. And resentment builds up. Resentment by Europeans builds up. Okay? And there starts to develop, you know, a hatred towards the Moors. I mean, it's deep what happened. And see what and see the biggest problem with the way the transatlantic slave trade is taught is that the connection between the 800-year occupation of the Moors in Europe and the animosity and hatred that Europeans had toward the Moors and Africans intermixing into the European population, changing the complexion of Europeans, darkening the complexion of Europeans, intermixing with the European bloodline. That is totally separate. The way the story is totally separate from the transatlantic slave trade. No, it's not separate. Transatlantic slave trade is a continuation of that. Because now you have things that are flipped. So the Moors were in power. Then the Moors get conquered. And then you're going to have Moors enslaved. And you have these Europeans going into Africa, enslaving these African people that they have been dealing with for hundreds of years. When the transatlantic slave trade started, this ain't the first time the Portuguese and the Spanish and the English and the French and the Germans, and this ain't the first time they were dealing with African people. They were dealing with them for hundreds of years in Europe. And the same thing that's taking place today, where you have a fear of the browning of America. The same thing that's happening today, where you have the fear of the browning of America, and you have some Europeans who are afraid that by 2043, they will become a minority population in this country. You had something similar to that going on in Europe with the browning of Europe. Because the Moors are intermixing into the populations. So this is how you get someone like Queen Charlotte Sophia, right? The wife of King George III. She was of African descent on her mother's side. Her mother had African Moorish ancestry. Well, she's the wife of King George III. Who was King George III? King George III was the king that the 13 colonies were revolting against. His wife was of African descent. And you're going to have a lot of these people. You're going to have a lot of these people like this who have mixed ancestry in Europe because of the Moors. So the transatlantic slave trade, even in one way, it's a beginning of something with chattel slavery. But another way, it's a continuation. And when you study the Spanish colonies, you study the English colonies, one of the first things they're going to do is create anti-miscegenation laws. What are anti-miscegenation laws? It made it illegal for the Spanish to intermix with the Africans. In general, basically they're talking about African men intermixing with Spanish women or African men intermixing with white women in general. This is what they're talking about. Why? Because they saw what happened for 800 years in Europe. Because see, when you really understand what racism is about, racism is all about sex. Racism is, look, let's break this down. Racism is a system of advantage and privilege distributed based upon race. Racism occurs when one race of people control the majority of the wealth, power, and resources, privileges, benefits, land, access to education, access to opportunity, media, jobs, healthcare, etc., right? Well, how do you determine that based upon race? You have to, because race wasn't, man created the races. Man created racism. So when you have laws to keep Africans from intermixing with Europeans, you're doing this to keep them from passing and to keep them from getting resources. So you want to keep Africans from having sex with Europeans, producing an offspring who can pass and get access to resources. So this is why you had these anti-miscegenation laws. They're trying to preserve their bloodline. This is what this is about. This is what people don't want to understand. Okay, J.A. Rogers had a series of books called Sex and Race. So when we go and we look at the history, even in this country, you had laws against the intermixing of the races. But we know white men kept doing it with African women who were enslaved. So it wasn't for them. Who was it for? It was to keep African men from doing it with white women. Why? Because they were doing it for hundreds of years in Europe. I mean, study the history. Even though they had the laws to keep Africans from intermixing with Europeans, white men kept doing it. They kept doing it to enslaved African women. No problem. No problem on their end. Problem on our end, of course. But they kept doing it. So who was it really for? So when we look at Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, the ISIS papers, the keys to the colors, and we study a legacy of racism, and we look at like the history of lynchings. Okay? Well, usually when you study the history of lynchings, Ida B. Wells found this out, okay, after the Moss Store murders in 1892 in Memphis, Tennessee, and her friends were lynched. Okay, when she started studying lynchings, she found out oftentimes the lynchings were as a result of consensual sex between black men and white women. And what happened was her husband found out, her brother found out, her father found out, her cousin found out, her uncle found out, and they went and got the good old boys and go lynch this African-American man. But it was consensual sex between a black man and a white woman. So when we look at racism, the race that has the highest concentrations of melanin, they get the brunt of racism because they have the greatest propensity, the greatest ability to change the complexion of Europeans. I'm saying it for a certain way because this is on social media platforms, and some of these social media platforms have new guidelines and things like this. So this is not hate speech. I'm dealing with history. Okay, when we talk about genetic and recessive genes, this is science. I'm not talking about superiority or inferiority. I'm dealing with science. Okay, so when you, so this is what this is all about. Is about African men and white women. What about white men and African women? Because they were doing it all through slavery. It wasn't a problem. So who was it for? Which goes back to hundreds of years of this happening in Europe. So really, when you understand the transatlantic slave trade chronologically, not starting in 1440 with the Portuguese getting involved, but understanding the previous hundreds of years of history, the transatlantic slave trade was really Europeans getting revenge on the African Moors and what happened in Europe. That's what this is about. When you study the Spanish instituted a law in the Spanish colonies that the African slaves could not learn to read or write. Well, it was the Moors that taught the Spanish to read and write, for the most part. Because when they go in the Iberian Peninsula in 711 A.D., 85-90% of Europeans are illiterate. It's the Moors that teach them how to read and write. Now, the priests knew how to read and write. They were the most literate. Most of the other ones were illiterate. You had kings and queens who were illiterate, couldn't read or write. It's the Moors. So when we study transatlantic slave trade, all this stuff gets flipped around. But the way a lot of people teach it, they don't deal with that because they haven't studied the history of the Moors. You have to understand what happened in Europe for hundreds of years to understand why the transatlantic slave trade happened. That didn't just fall out of the sky. That didn't just pop up as a fluke. No, this is the result of animosity and wars fought between Africans and Europeans. Okay? All right. So, these are some of the things that we deal with in the online course also. So, the way I deal with transatlantic slave trade is different than a lot of other people because of the way, because of the information that I study and who some of my teachers are. Professor Kabahai Wapakamane, who was brilliant when it comes to the history of the Moors. And Professor James Small, Dr. Linda Jeffries, things like this. So they when they teach it, they teach it chronologically. They taught me to teach it chronologically. Okay, you can't teach it episodically. You can't teach it as an episode in history. Professor Kaba talks about how to understand the existence of something, you must first understand the pre-existence of existence. And one of the things that the Spanish were doing when they're conquering the Moors in Spain is they are enslaving some of them and taking them as slaves into Spanish territories, like Florida and South Carolina. Those were Spanish territories before they were part of what we call the United States. Those were Spanish territories because the Spanish were in this land we call the U.S. before the English. This is why when people talk about August 20th, 1619, Jamestown, Virginia, well, the Spanish were enslaving Africans in the territory we call South Carolina going back to the 1520s. That's about 100 years before that. That's not even talked about. But this is why you have to understand the chronology of history. Okay? All right. We've got Eric, Dirk, Martel. Then also use this as a resource. This is something I use in the online course. This is something I talked about today in my presentation because, you know, it's at the Black Homeschooling Conference. A lot of people don't know about this study. Now, those that watch me regularly, you've heard me talk about this. Teaching Hard History, American Slavery by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Teaching Hard History, American Slavery. I don't know if they talk about the history of the Moors. I doubt it. But two important things they do in this study, and you can download it from splcenter.org. Two important things they do. One, they document how the history of slavery is being incorrectly taught in schools all across the country. Not just our schools, but white people's schools also. One. Two, they show how and give numerous recommendations on how to more correctly teach the history of slavery, which is extremely important. Because if we're ever going to get reparations, if we're ever going to get reparations, America must have a massive history lesson. Because Americans are ignorant of history. So how do you think reparations are going to be paid out and most people don't even understand the history of slavery? Most African-Americans don't even understand the history of slavery. You think trillions of dollars in reparations are going to be paid out? I mean, you must still believe in Santa Claus if you believe something like that. America needs a massive history lesson. Okay, so let's look at this here. How's everybody doing? An African-American business owner is supposed to name your business here on the thread of the broadcast as well. Okay, we'll give you a shout-out. Email us at customerservice@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. We'll let you know how you can advertise with the African History Network on our broadcast and on the podcast of our Sunday night show also. We're on 8 different podcast platforms as well. All right? And check out Mercedes Waffles and More. Mercedes Waffles and More. Those in the New York, New Jersey area. They have vegan soul food, okay? And they do catering. Mercedes, Waffles, and More, okay? Check them out. MercedesWafflesAndMore.com. All right, so let's jump into this. 6 principles of political self-defense. We laid out what politics is. Now, why are these 6 principles so important, right? So in a political election, what takes place is, if you're not operating based upon an agenda, then you're going to be sidetracked by whoever has a viral video this week, whoever has a catchphrase next week, things like this. You'll be sidetracked by these things that are superfluous, all right? And this is what happened at the first debate. And now this may go outside the circumference of some people's awareness. Some people may not like this, but Kamala Harris did her little Academy Award winning performance, right? But very few people, and I call people out on MSNBC about this because their coverage and their journalistic integrity was lacking on how they covered Joe Biden's comments about working with segregationists, because he was talking about working with segregationists to get laws passed because it was segregationists who were in control. He talked about people like Senator James Eastland of Mississippi, who was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he talked about also defeating them. He talked about defeating them as well. He talked about them being vile, repugnant human beings. But you had, these are guys that when he got into the Senate in 1973, these were the people running the Senate. These were Democrats. That's the other thing nobody talked about. These were Democrats he was talking about working with. I don't know why people didn't say these segregationists were Democrats he was talking about working with. Okay? This is what he explained to Reverend Al Sharpton June 23rd, 2019. I played the video for you. Go check out my the videos on my YouTube channel, because I went and broke this down by segments, okay? And then when Reverend Al Sharpton interviewed Representative Cedric Richmond, who's Biden's co-chair, on June 29, 2019, Sharpton acted like he had amnesia from his conversation with Joe Biden June 23rd. Biden went through explaining all this. When Biden was talking about, I watch MSNBC, so I know exactly what they say. This is a problem I have, and I called them out on Twitter about this. When Biden was talking about using the term boy and son, it had nothing to do with black men being called boy. This is something that Cory Booker jumped to conclusions on, and Cory Booker really should jump out of the race. I don't know why he's in there. This is something that Reverend Al Sharpton jumped to conclusions on. Joe Biden told Reverend Al Sharpton June 23rd, he said, wait a second. He said, I wasn't talking about boy being used for black men. He said, when I said they called me son, not boy, he said, that's because they called Ted Kennedy boy. They called me son. He said, they didn't call me senator, they called me son. He said, the reason why was because they thought both of us were too young to be in the U.S. Senate. So they called Senator Ted Kennedy, who was white, boy, and they called me son. This had nothing to do with black men being called boy. But you saw Reverend Al Sharpton jumping out here with that BS. You saw Cory Booker jumping out here with that BS. And the whole way this whole thing was covered was totally disingenuous. Then the Associated Press reported on either July 3rd or July 4th, 2019, that Kamala Harris backtracked on her statements about forced busing and said that busing should be considered but not mandated. Well, if that's your stance, what the hell was that you were talking about on the debate stage then for? But I noticed when they bring this up about Biden, they will talk about, on MSNBC, they'll talk about segregationists and won't give context. 99% of the time, they won't say he was talking about working with Democrats who were segregationists, and he was a Democrat. They won't bring that up. They won't put it in context. And then they won't say, well, Senator Kamala Harris had to back away from her statements on forced busing. And she said busing should be considered but not mandated. So game recognizes game. You can't slick a can of oil. So what happens is, during a political election, it's easy to become distracted by viral videos and catchphrases. If we're not operating based upon an agenda, we won't fight for policies that are beneficial for us. We'll get sidetracked with this nonsense, okay? And the other thing is, it's extremely important. The presidency is not won by winning debates. The presidency is won by winning states. And this is what people don't want to talk about. It's not won by winning debates. It's won by winning states. The Electoral College votes are associated with you winning the state. You're going to have to win the state of Florida. You're going to have to win the state of North Carolina, probably the state of Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Now, if you look at this article from NBCNews.com, we posted this article on our Facebook fan page, the African History Network, okay, a couple days ago. This is from NBCNews.com. This is from July 19th, 2019. How many of you all saw this article? The name of this article is How Trump Could Lose by 5 Million Votes and Still Win in 2020. How Trump Could Lose by 5 Million Votes and Still Win in 2020. The nation's two most populous states, California and Texas, are at the heart of Democrats' geography problem, because Trump could lose Texas and California and still win in the Electoral College. And we don't even understand how the Electoral College works. Because we're listening to these people running their mouths who have no clue what they're talking about. This is why when I hear people saying, oh, I'm going to vote for this person because they can stand toe-to-toe with Donald Trump in a debate. Do you understand that by the time the actual presidential debates happen, the three presidential debates, when the Republicans choose their nominee and Democrats choose their nominee, there are three presidential debates. Most people have already made up their mind by then. So the presidency is not won by winning debates, it's won by winning states. But we don't understand how Electoral College works. This is something I talked about in my presentation today, right? This is what the whole citizenship question on the U.S. Census is about. Citizenship question hasn't been on the U.S. Census in like 60 or 70 years. So why are you trying to put it on now? No, they're trying to change the balance of power. How does this work? What does the U.S. Census do? U.S. Census doesn't count every citizen in the U.S. It counts everybody in the U.S. It's population, okay? Well, what is the U.S. Census impact? It impacts funding for districts, impacts funding for cities based upon increases in population, decreases in population. But the census also impacts congressional representation. Congressional representation that a city has or a state has, congressional district, what is that based upon? Increases in population, decreases in population. If your city or a district has decreases in population, you can lose a congressional seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. You can lose congressional representation for your state. If your state, if your city, your district has increases in population, you can gain seats in the House of Representatives, or they may split your district, okay? So, for instance, the state of Michigan has 16 Electoral College votes. What determines how many Electoral College votes a state has? What is that based upon? It's based upon population. How is it based upon population? You take the number of seats in the U.S. House of Representatives a state has, and you add to it the number of U.S. Senate seats that a state has. Well, every state has two U.S. Senate seats. That's based upon U.S. Constitution, which goes back to law, which goes back to the foundation, U.S. Constitution, okay? The House of Representatives is based upon population. But based upon population, based upon what? Based upon population, based upon the U.S. Senate count. The U.S. Census count. Okay? So, if you put a citizenship question on the U.S. Census, and you have people, you have families, where one person in the family is a legal immigrant, another person in the family is undocumented, you can have the entire family that not respond to the census. You drive down the actual population count in certain cities, in certain states, in certain Democratic-leaning states. If they lose population, they can also lose congressional representation. What does that mean? That means they lose seats in the House of Representatives, which means they lose Electoral College votes associated with their state, which weakens their power when it comes to getting to 270 Electoral College votes. That's what all this is about. This is about shifting the balance of power. So you can have an increase in population, but if it's not counted in the census, it doesn't matter. So this is the game that Republicans and Trump are running to maintain power and weaken the Electoral College power that Democratic states have. That's what this is about. And this is about the fear of the Browning of America. U.S. Census released a press release in June of 2018 that talked about how white people have a negative birth rate in 26 states out of 50. That's not me. That's the U.S. Census Bureau. Don't get mad at me. This ain't hate speech. This is science. This is documented, okay? 26 states out of 50. 2 years before that, it was 17 states out of 50. A lot of this is directly tied to the opioid crisis. So you have a fear of the Browning of America. Okay? And let me see. I'll give you the exact press release from the census. let me see, that came out in June of 2018. It was it's census.gov, and it is, let's see, is that 47 minutes of press release? I think this is it right here because I have all this stuff bookmarked. Midwest home to most other counties with decreases in median age. June 21st, 2018, census.gov, U.S. Census Bureau. Midwest home, HOME, to most other counties with decreases in median age. Okay. And they talked about how, let me see something here. In here, I think this is the one they talked about how white people have a negative birth rate in 26 states out of 50. Okay, let's see here. What is this? Baby boomers and millennial alike are responsible for this trend in increased aging. Hispanic population made up 18.1% of the nation's top population in 2017, primarily due to natural increase, the difference between births and deaths. Okay, but it's in here. Read this. We'll post the link here for you. You can check this out. Okay, this came out June 28th, 2018. Okay, read this here. That's from the U.S. Census Bureau. Okay, so we have to understand how these laws and policies are put in place to shift the balance of power. All this deals with politics is the legal distribution of scarce wealth, power, and resources. I didn't say the fair distribution. I didn't say the moral distribution. I said the legal distribution. Okay? So when we look at six principles of political self-defense, one is match, MATCH, not match.com. That's something else. This is match. Elect someone whose policies best match our issues and concerns. This is why Black Agenda is so necessary, to give standards and hold people accountable. But to be able to put together an agenda, you have to understand your condition. To understand your condition, you have to understand the history of how you got into that predicament. And you have to understand your history as well and understand which direction you should be going in. Okay, so this is why African history and culture is the foundation. It gives us our values, our interests, and our principles. This influences our economic empowerment and our political empowerment. Okay, so if we look at African Americans who organized to get Senator Doug Jones elected in Alabama, they looked at his issues, they looked at his policies, and they saw that his policies that's best matched up with what their issues were in comparison to Doug Jones. I mean, not Doug Jones, Roy Moore. Okay, we all remember Roy Moore, who had the problem with the little young girls. Okay, and they saw Roy Moore as death. They knew Roy Moore was terrible. When we look at Alabama, Alabama is basically about 50th in the country in education, and they're number one in incarceration. NBCNews.com had an article, and I talked about it when it came out because I covered this special election. December 12, 2017, Moore versus Jones, where the Alabama Senate candidates stand on the issues, okay? Moore versus Jones, where the Alabama Senate candidates stand on the issues. African Americans looked at Doug Jones' policies. They looked at what they were concerned about. Saving the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare. They looked at Jones' stances on fixing Obamacare. They looked at abortion rights. They looked at a number of different things. Yeah, I'm going through looking at this quickly here. Let's see here. Yeah, they looked at crime. Supporting criminal justice reform. Criminal justice reform. Doug Jones' stances on criminal justice reform better lined up with theirs, because Roy Moore, really didn't have any clear plans when it came to criminal justice reform, okay? They looked at immigration. They looked at climate change. It was a number of different things, okay? So check out this article here. So we have to understand this. This gets past name recognition. This gets past personalities. This even gets past political party, because it's not about political parties. It's about the policies, okay? I'm neither Democrat nor Republican. Now, I look and see, I look at where a lot of these crazy-ass policies come from, and they come from Republicans, majority of them, especially on the national level. But it's not about political party. It's about the policies. Okay? All right. So name of that. So we posted that article there. That's dealing with Roy Moore and Doug Jones. That's from NBCNews.com. All right. Number two is create. Someone who we have to elect someone who can create an environment for us to push our agenda the farthest and get the most accomplished. This doesn't just mean president. Definitely president. It could be governor. It could be mayor. Okay? Someone who can create an environment for us to push our agenda the farthest and get the most accomplished. Especially when you deal with a governor, a president, a mayor, something like that. They have a lot of influence. Okay? And they can create openings for you to be able to push your agenda through and get things accomplished. If we're not operating based upon an agenda, we're going to be lost. Let me give you an example. 2016. See, a lot of people are under the impression that the 63 million people that voted for Trump in the 2016 election, they all love Trump. That's not true. Some of them hated Trump. But Republicans were operating based upon an agenda. What was their agenda? Their agenda was to gain control of the U.S. Supreme Court. Their agenda was to gain control of the federal courts, influence law for the next 20, 30 years. They said they wanted to repeal Roe versus Wade, 1973. You do that in the courts. This is why they got these crazy laws like in Alabama, things like this, these crazy laws that are anti-abortion, okay? And it's designed to try to hurry up and get this to the U.S. Supreme Court to get a ruling on this, because they're trying to overturn Roe versus Wade. Well, Donald Trump has gotten two Supreme Court nominations confirmed. One was stolen from President Obama, okay? That was Merrick Garland, who was blocked by Senator Mitch McConnell, son of a Mitch, from Kentucky. This is why Republicans fought so hard to maintain control of the U.S. Senate, because it's the Senate that confirms Supreme Court nominations, and it's the Senate that confirms federal judges. And Mitch McConnell is totally committed to getting as many ultra-conservative federal judges confirmed as possible. Trump has nominated 143 federal judges. He's gotten 123 confirmed. Ellie Mostal, this morning on MSNBC, on David Gura's show, because I was watching it in the hotel before I went to the conference, and I was putting the finishing touches on my presentation. Ellie Mostal wrote an article, who's an attorney, African-American attorney. You see him on MSNBC. He has big gray afro, looking kind of like Frederick Douglass somewhat. Not to be confused with Cornell Belcher, who has a big gray afro, looks kind of like Frederick Douglass also. But Ellie Mostal has an article from July 15, 2019 called Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. Donald Trump and the Plot to Take Over the Courts. How the 45th president, really he's the 44th president. This is why you don't hear me call Trump 45, because there have only been 44 presidents under the U.S. Constitution, because President Grover Cleveland was elected to two non-consecutive terms, okay? So Trump is actually 44, but whatever. I don't call him 45. But how the 45th president has packed the courts with ultra-conservatives and reshaped the judiciary for a generation. Now, I've talked about this numerous times, okay? Ellie Mostal has a good article here from the for thenation.com that talks about this. And in the article, he says, but Trump's court, the collection of judges and justices now swarming our judicial system, nominated and confirmed to lifetime appointments. These are lifetime, federal judge is a lifetime appointment, okay? Nominated and confirmed to lifetime appointments on his recommendation will linger like an infected wound poisoning the body politic even after the initial injury has scabbed over. So years after Trump is gone, however he gets out of there, okay, whatever happens, whether he's impeached, whether he resigns, whatever happens, okay, years after this, those federal judges will still be on the court making decisions that impact us. They're nominated. So these judges are coming from, these are names being submitted by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, these two right-wing, very conservative organizations, okay? These are very young, ultra-conservative white males who are being nominated, and many of them are just totally unqualified to be federal judges. So, as of the writing of this article, which was July 15th, 2019, the Trump administration has had 123 federal judges confirmed, including 41 to the Federal Court of Appeals. The circuit courts just one rung below the U.S. Supreme Court. Okay? The circuit courts are just one rung below the U.S. Supreme Court. By comparison, at this point in his presidency, Barack Obama had pushed only 19 circuit court judges through to confirmation. Trump's appointees now account for some 14% of the federal judiciary and more than 22% of the judges on the nation's Court of Appeals. And he has been in office for just 2.5 years. Okay? So what happened was, 2014, Democrats lose control of the U.S. Senate in the midterm elections. Mitch McConnell becomes Senate Majority Leader. Mitch McConnell blocked all these nominations to the federal bench that President Obama made. They blocked his confirmations. Why? Because as Senate Majority Leader, you determine which hearings take place or whether they don't take place. You determine which bills come to the floor for debate. You determine which bills come to the Senate floor for a vote. As Senate Majority Leader, you determine it. So you got one little troll-ass son of a Mitch senator that's controlling all of this. This is an example of how elections have consequences. This is what we don't understand. So when Trump became president through the Electoral College, because he lost the popular vote by 2.9 million votes, there were about 103 vacancies there on the federal bench. Okay? Blocked by Mitch McConnell. So it left all these vacancies for Trump to fill. That's on top of the two U.S. Supreme Court justices he got nominated. He got confirmed. Neil Gorsuch and Neil Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. Okay? That choir boy, Kavanaugh. But this is all understanding how politics impacts every aspect of our lives. Okay? So you have to ask yourself the question, well, wait a second. If, you know, you ready to sit back and ask yourself the question, why are Republicans fighting so hard to maintain and to gain control of the courts and maintain control of the courts? Because they want to control federal law for the next 20 or 30 years. That's what this is about. This is about controlling law, controlling policies. Okay, so check out that article by Ellie Mostal. So what happened was in 2016, I watched numerous interviews with Donald Trump supporters. I watched about 100 campaign speeches and interviews Trump did in 2016. I was doing national radio 5 days a week, okay? And then doing local radio in Detroit 2 days a week. So Trump supporters were saying, this is about the Supreme Court. They made it plain. They said, this is about the Supreme Court. They were operating based upon an agenda. They were operating based upon an agenda because they were trying to achieve goals or trying to achieve a purpose. Overturn Roe versus Wade. Gain control of the U.S. Supreme Court. Gain control of the federal courts. This is what this was about. A lot of people that voted for Trump did not like Trump. You have his base that likes him. You had others that voted for Trump, not because they liked him, but because they wanted to fulfill the agenda. And they saw Trump as a means to fulfill the agenda. Just like the evangelicals. Okay? How is it that you got a guy, how is it that you support a guy who has sex with porno stars and Playboy bunnies, cheats on his wives, okay? He does. He has at least 16 women accusing him of sexual misconduct, sexual assault, all types of stuff like this. But this is your guy? This is who you want? No, it's because he's providing you with Supreme Court justices. He said he would nominate Supreme Court justices that will overturn Roe versus Wade. All this, so they're going to overlook all this sin. They're going to overlook all this other stuff because of what President Obama did, one-tenth of this that Trump did. They would call President Obama the Antichrist. Let's keep it real, okay? See, Trump is everything that white people thought President Obama was going to be. Trump cheated on all three of his wives, had children by different babies' mamas, had sex with porno stars, Playboy bunnies, doesn't understand the U.S. Constitution, doesn't understand law. Trump is everything that white people thought President Obama would be. And then, to add insult to injury, Michelle Obama was just named the most admirable woman in the world. I think it was in the world, most admirable woman in the world. Right? To add insult to injury. Okay? So Trump is everything white people thought President Obama would be. President Obama was a constitutional law expert, a constitutional law professor. He was an attorney. I don't ever think Trump has ever read the Constitution. He sure as hell don't act like it. So, let's continue here. How's everybody doing? How y'all like this type of information? Now, who still needs to register for our Wednesday online course, Ancient Kemet, the Moors, and the Ma'afa, Understanding the Transatlantic Slave Trade, what they didn't teach you in school? Let me know. I'll post the link again. Class meets Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's an 8-week, 16-hour online course. All the sessions are archived. We do it live. All the sessions are archived. We deal with thousands of years of history. It's regularly $130, on sale $80. There's about 36 hours of bonus content also. All right, number three is stop. Stop financing our own dehumanization. Stop financing our own dehumanization. Many times we do this and don't know it. Many of us are invested in privatized prisons through our 401k plans and our pension fund plans and don't know it. I'm not telling you get rid of your 401k plans and pension fund plans. We need those for retirement. I'm not saying that. What I am saying is that you can call your benefits manager on Monday and you can find out which industries and companies that you are invested in. Now, let's look at an example of some people who actually did this. So, in the city of New York, in June of 2017, you had city employees for the city of New York that divested $48 million of their pension fund dollars from three privatized prisons because they found out they were invested in privatized prisons. They said, well, you may have privatized prisons, but you're not going to do it without money. See, a lot of people don't know you can do this. A lot of people don't know that they are invested in privatized prisons. A lot of people are invested in gun manufacturers through their pension funds, through their 401k plans, and don't know it. Okay? Reverend Al Sharpton has talked about on his radio show, Keeping It Real, and then also at the State of Black America that Roland Martin hosted. And we shared it on our Facebook fan page. You can watch it on Roland's YouTube channel, Roland Martin on YouTube. Reverend Sharpton, regardless of whether you like him or not, this is not about personality. This is about understanding policy. He talked about how one of the initiatives of the National Action Network this year is dealing with pension funds. And he said that a lot of African Americans are financing our own gentrification and don't understand it because our pension fund dollars are handled by money managers who then will loan that money to developers. those developers then take that money from the pension funds and use it to gentrify us out of our own communities, and we're paying for it and don't even understand this. So if we look at this article here from New York Daily News, June 8th, 2017, NYC pension fund to back out of investments in private prisons. NYC pension fund to back out of investments in private prisons. New York City's pension system has become the first in the nation to fully divest from private prisons. Controller Scott Stringer will announce on Thursday. They actually did it. They actually withdrew from these privatized prisons. The city has sold off about $48 million in stocks and bonds of three private prison companies, according to the controller's office, after a unanimous vote from the fund's trustees. The move comes after a scathing federal audit of private prison facilities last year, which would be 2016, after eight immigrant detainees have died in the last fiscal year while in private immigration detention centers. We know it's gotten a lot worse. And as I talked about today in my presentation at the Liberated Minds Black Homeschooling Education Expo, this detaining of migrants and migrant children, this is big business for privatized prison companies. This is big business for them. And after eight immigrant detainees have died in the last fiscal year, while in private immigration detention centers, which house 65% of immigration and customs enforcement detainees, according to Stringer's office. Morally, the industry wants to turn back the clock on years of progress on criminal justice, and we can't sit idly by and watch that happen, end quote, Stringer said. Because, see, a lot of people don't know the U.S. prison population dropped to its lowest point in 20 years under President Obama in December 2015. Nobody wants to talk about this. This was revealed in the December 2016 Department of Justice report. And I found out about, the first place I found out about this was from Newsweek.com, okay? Newsweek had an article from December 2016 that talked about how the U.S. prison population, I'll give you the name of the article, you can read this yourself. The U.S. prison population exceeded 1.5 million in 2015. But when you actually read the article, it talks about how the U.S. prison population fell the most in almost four decades to 1.53 million inmates in 2015, resulting in the lowest rate of incarceration in a generation, the Department of Justice said. The drop has been driven by changes in federal and state corrections policies that include drug treatment programs and the sentencing of fewer nonviolent drug offenders to federal prisons, the department said in its year-end report on prison population. This was under President Obama. Why doesn't anybody talk about this? The U.S. prison population dropped to its lowest point in 20 years under President Obama. Trump wants a pat on the back for the First Step Act. The population of African Americans in prison dropped from 40% down to 34% under President Obama. Now, in August of 2016, President Obama announced that the federal government would not renew contracts for federal prisoners with privatized prison companies like CoreCivic and Geo Group. They announced they would not renew that. CoreCivic and Geo Group, who are the two largest owner operators of privatized prisons in the country. They're publicly traded stocks. CoreCivic used to be Corrections Corporation of America. And CoreCivic, they're a Tennessee-based company. And let's see, what's their stock exchange symbol? I think it's CXW for CoreCivic. You can look it up. I think Core Civic is CXW. Let me see something here. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal. I thought it said in this one here. I'll look it up quickly here, but I think it's CXW for Core Civic. They used to be Corrections Corporation of America. But Core Civic and Geo Group donated almost $600,000 to Donald Trump's presidential campaign. After Trump said he was going to self-finance his campaign. That was a lie. So then after Trump becomes president through the Electoral College, because 2.9 million more people didn't want his ass as president, he reverses President Obama's policy dealing with privatized prisons, and they renewed the contracts. But then if we look at who's getting a lot of these contracts to house migrant children, right? Let's look at this article from the Wall Street Journal. July 2nd, 2018. Trump's immigrant detention plans benefit private prison operators. This is the Wall Street Journal, which is a conservative publication owned by Rupert Murdoch. Trump's immigrant detention plans benefit private prison operators. Core Civic, Geo Group, both Trump campaign contributors. So I ain't making this up. This is white people telling you this. Core Civic, Geo Group, both Trump campaign contributors have become more reliant on ICE revenue in recent years. The Trump administration's new push, now this is from July 2nd, 2018, follow the money. The Trump administration's new push for more federal detention facilities for immigrants awaiting asylum hearings or deportation has brightened the outlook for the country's two largest private prison operators, Tennessee-based Core Civic Inc. and Florida-based Geo Group, had already been helped by higher federal spending on immigration and customs enforcement. Now, the Trump administration is seeking $2.8 billion in the 2019 budget year to increase the number of beds in immigration detention centers to 52,000, 49,500 for adults, 2,500 for family beds. Okay, so they want to increase that. And then, let me see something here. So this article deals with following the money, okay? All right, you can read the rest of this. We'll post a link here. You read the rest of this, but this deals with following the money. Then there's an article from the New York Times, the billion-dollar business of operating shelters for migrant children. The billion-dollar business of operating shelters for migrant children, June 21st, 2018, same date that that press release from the U.S. Census came out. The business of housing, transporting, and watching over migrant children detained along the southwest border is not a multi-million dollar business, it's a billion-dollar business. The nonprofit Southwest Key Programs has won at least $955 million in federal contracts since 2015 to run shelters and provide other services to immigrant children in federal custody. Its shelter for migrant boys at a former Walmart supercenter in South Texas has been the focus of nationwide scrutiny. But Southwest Key is but one player in the lucrative, secretive world of the migrant shelter business. About a dozen contractors operate more than 30 facilities in Texas alone, with numerous others contracted for about 100 shelters in 16 other states. I wonder how many of these businesses donated to Trump's campaign, his 2016 campaign, or his reelection campaign. I'm just curious. I'm not saying they did. I'd be curious to know how many. I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of them did, though. Okay? So that's from New York Times, the billion-dollar business of operating shelters for migrant children. Now, what we have to understand is our taxpayer dollars pay for this. See, our taxpayer dollars pay for this. So whether you agree with it or not, our taxpayer dollars are being used to finance this. All right, so let's continue here for a little while longer. And let me post the link here. You can register for our online class that meets Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Ancient Kemet, the Moors, and the Ma'afa, understanding the transatlantic slave trade, what they didn't teach you in school. All right, and then African American business owners, email us at customerservice@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. And we'll let you know how you can advertise with the African History Network. We can promote your business through our Facebook Live broadcast and on the audio podcast of our shows, our Sunday night show, the African History Network show, and the broadcast we do throughout the week. We're on 8 different podcast platforms, including iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, CastBox, Acast, FM Player, and Stitcher. All right, so let's continue. Okay. Another thing that I talked about dealing with policy and law. So the Atlantic.com has a really good article from October 7th, 2013. How prisons change the balance of power in America. How prisons change the balance of power in America. The way all this stuff works, most of us don't even understand. This ties right into population and ties right into the census. Here's the excerpt of the article. Disfranchising thousands of voters is only part of the story of how mass incarceration has distorted American democracy. Today, just as it did more than 100 years earlier, the way the U.S. Census calculates resident population also plays a subtle but significant role. As ex-Confederates knew well, after the Civil War ends in 1865, as ex-Confederates knew well, prisoners would be counted as residents of a given county, even if they could not themselves vote. High numbers of prisoners could easily translate to greater political power for those who put them behind bars. High numbers of prisoners could easily translate to greater political party, greater political power for those who put them behind bars. How is this possible, Michael Imhotep? With the advent of mass incarceration and as the number of people in prison not only rose dramatically, but also began moving urbanites of color into overwhelmingly white rural counties that housed prisons, the political process was again distorted. In short, thanks to this process that we now call prison gerrymandering, overwhelmingly white and Republican areas of the United States that built prisons, as the war on crime escalated, got more political power, whereas areas of the country where policing was particularly concentrated and aggressive, areas in which levels of incarceration were, as a result, staggering, lost political power. What does this mean? How does this happen? Most prisons are in white rural districts, white rural areas that are heavily Republican areas, heavily Republican districts. So when African Americans go to prison, oftentimes they live in the inner city. They live in Detroit, Chicago, Atlanta, what have you, Philadelphia. When they go to prison, the prison is oftentimes usually in a rural district that's Republican. When you go to prison, your residency changes from the city that you lived in to the city that prison is in. which means the city that you came from, Detroit, Atlanta, Philadelphia, loses population count. The city that you're housed in gains population count. Congressional districts are based upon population, increases and decreases of population. So when you shift population from inner cities to rural districts, as far as prisons, this increases their population, which means these areas, these rural districts, can gain congressional representation. And your district and your city can lose congressional representation. So as they talk about here, overwhelmingly white, in short, thanks to this process that we now call prison gerrymandering, overwhelmingly white and Republican areas of the United States that built prisons as the war on crime escalated, got more political. As the war on crime escalated, got more political power. Whereas areas of the country where policing was particularly concentrated and aggressive, areas in which levels of concentration were, as a result, staggering, lost political power. Also, funding, based upon the census count, funding coming from the federal government is based upon population. Well, if your city loses a significant amount of population, partly due to people being incarcerated, you could lose federal funding to your city. And then when those people are housed in rural districts and these districts have an increase in population, they can gain federal funding from the federal government through the census. So read this full article. This is from theatlantic.com. How prisons change the balance of power in America. So number four, when we look at six principles of political self-defense, number four is push it. Okay, like Salt and Pepper said, push it. We have to elect someone who we can push in the right direction to do the right thing. Okay, they don't have to be perfect. We're trying to find perfect elected officials to serve imperfect people. An example of this is President Roosevelt in Executive Order 8802, signed June 25th, 1941, which desegregated jobs in the Department of Defense. Executive Order 8802. Why did he sign this? It wasn't out of the kindness of his own heart. It was because A. Philip Randolph, president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, leveraged his position with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and threatened to put 100,000 African Americans marching on Washington to embarrass President Roosevelt if he didn't desegregate these jobs in the Department of Defense for African Americans. So June 25th, 1941, Roosevelt signed Executive Order 8802. So, A. Philip Randolph was operating based upon an agenda to break the back of segregation and desegregate America, desegregate these opportunities, desegregate these jobs. He was operating based upon an agenda. Britannica.com has an article dealing with that. Executive Order 8802. So number five is leverage. We have to understand how to leverage our economics to enforce our agenda. We talk about pension funds, things like this. But example of this is FEC.gov, the Federal Elections Commission, FEC.gov, okay? And with the Federal Elections Commission, FEC.gov, you can search for any elected official at the federal level, U.S. House of Representatives, U.S. Senate, or President. You can find out who donated to that campaign, the person's name, the company this person works for, how much they donated. You can also find out corporations that donated to an elected official's campaign as well. So when Senator Cindy Hyde Smith of Mississippi, the public hanging woman, when she made her comments about sitting in the front row of public hanging, a report came out detailing corporations that had donated to her campaign. When corporations were exposed as donating money, they started asking for their money back. Well, what happened was it was a reporter article published about this, but these people went to FEC.gov to research this. Because I went to FEC.gov also to look. And you go there, look up Cindy Hyde Smith, Mississippi, and it shows who donated to her campaign. That's leverage to use against corporations who we spend dollars with who's supporting people whose policies are detrimental to us. We could threaten economic withdrawal from these businesses to push a political agenda, okay? To get them to withdraw support from these elected officials who are putting in place policies that are detrimental to us. Number six is protect. Protect our gains that are made during the previous elections. Because see, oftentimes we'll vote transactionally from election to election, but don't connect this election to the previous two, what was accomplished in the last 2 years, 4 years, which policies, laws, etc., are at stake of being reversed, things like that. We vote transactionally, but we don't understand the concept of protecting our gains. And oftentimes, it's not so much what an elected official can do for you, but it's about stopping someone who's trying to do something to you. So in each election, based upon the way the candidates shape up, the strategy may change, but you're still operating based upon an agenda. Okay, so that deals with six principles of political self-defense. I also got into economic empowerment, dealing with the co-ops and some of our history of co-ops, but I don't have time to get into this now. So we'll have a full presentation on DVD later this week, six principles of political self-defense. That'll be at AfricanHistoryNetwork.com, and we'll put that on our Facebook fan page, the African History Network also. All right, let's see who we have here. Okay, Eric, Gregory, Martel, Carl, how's everybody doing? Okay, also, if you like this type of information, you can donate to the African History Network, paypal.me/the AHN show. paypal.me/the AHN show. So we definitely need your support. This helps us to stay on the air. This helps pay for expenses without the travel. And I'll be in Atlanta, it looks like, August 3rd for the Black Agenda Tour with Michi X and Jice Johnson. So I got to pay my way there, pay my way back, things like that. So that helps support that. paypal.me/the AHN show. If you want to donate $15, $25, $50, $100, what have you. If you want to set up for a recurring donation, you can do that also. You can also go to our website, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com, AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. Okay, and click on the yellow donate button right on the homepage. And my DVD lectures are there also. And we have bundle packs, so you can order those. And be sure to register for the online course that I teach. Now, if you've taken this online course that I teach in the past, email me at customerservice@AfricanHistoryNetwork.com. We'll enroll you at 50% off. If you've taken this course with me in the past, I just go into our system and verify that you've taken the course in the past. And we'll enroll you at 50% off, okay? So, course is on sale now, $80, regularly $130. It's an 8-week, 16-hour online course, Ancient Kemet, the Moors, and the Ma'afa, understanding the transatlantic slave trade, what they did teach you in school. Okay, so we get to thousands of years of history. As soon as you register, you can watch the first four courses. And we do a live Wednesdays, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then after that, all the sessions are recorded. And there's also about 36 hours of bonus content. You can watch from around the world. Works best if you use Google Chrome, okay, as your browser. But when we discuss the transatlantic slave trade, we have to first understand that African people are the original people of North, Central, and South America, and have been in what we call the United States of America at least 51,700 years. This does not mean the transatlantic slave trade did not happen. Yes, it did. We have to understand thousands of years of history prior to the transatlantic slave trade happening. We cannot start our history in slavery. Even when we study the transatlantic slave trade, which is important to study, we can't start in 1619 or in the 1440s with the Portuguese, when the Portuguese get involved. We have to understand the history chronologically and deal with the 800-year occupation of Europe by the Africans known as the Moors, who take the teachings from ancient Kemet from the Nile Valley region of Africa into Europe, and this brings Europe out of the Dark Ages. Okay? All right, so these are some of the things that we deal with in the online course. So we posted the link there for you. And I'm trying to make sure I got through this. Dealing with Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson, I'll have to do a separate broadcast on that because we're running out of time and I'm running low on energy. It's been a long, long day. It's been a long weekend. Let's see here. We have. Okay. Just post any questions, comments you have before we get out of here. Those in Atlanta, I'll be in Atlanta August 3rd. If you want me to do a presentation for your group or organization, also email me at customerservice@africanhistorynetwork.com. Customerservice@africanhistorynetwork.com. If you want me to do a presentation for your group or organization. All right, now, summertime is here. People are trying to get in shape, and the Fast Life 28-Day Challenge can help you with that. This is a 28-day program that deals with the power of fasting, and they put you on a nutritional regimen. They have online coaching for you. There is a special Facebook group for you as well. You have three coaches to help you also. Visit their website, tfl28.com, tfl28.com, for the Fast Life 28-Day Challenge. And they have a new course starting soon, or one that just started. They have a new group starting soon, or one that just started also. Visit tfl28.com for more information. All right, guys, look, hey, I have to get out of here. I'm headed back to Detroit on Monday, so I have to fly back. So follow us on our Facebook fan page, the African History Network, YouTube channel, Michael Imhotep, Imhotep. And remember, at the African History Network, we focus on educating, empowering, and inspiring people of African descent throughout the diaspora and around the world, because right now it corrects wrong behavior. What you do for yourself, what you do to yourself, and what you allow other people to do to you and get away with is based upon what you think about yourself. What you think about yourself is based upon what you have been taught about yourself. What you've been taught about yourself is based upon everything you've read, heard, and seen about yourself. Remember, right now is correct wrong behavior. It's not over till we win. Wakanda forever. We'll talk to you next time. Peace.